The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Victoria Brooks is a writer and researcher in the area of law and sexual ethics. She teaches criminal law, criminology and the law, philosophy of law, and law of the environment at the University of Westminster. She is intent on systematically fucking the law, otherwise known as persistently and unflinchingly questioning regimes of sexual ethics, and her book, Fucking Law, is out now from Zero Books. It's Monday, July 15th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week's podcast is available in full for Patreon supporters. Our Patreon supporters get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. But if you're listening on our free feed, you'll always be able to access one or the other podcasts each week. Patrons also receive access to our new video series called The History of Communism on a monthly basis. The music you're listening to right now is called Look Straight Ahead. It's from the Storyblocks stock footage and stock audio site. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Victoria Brooks, Fuck the Law.
Fucking law, what is it? It's an attack on philosophy in the name of women's sexuality. How I came to write it, I wanted the book to be really unflinching and to be really talking frankly about sexuality and my personal experience of sexuality, and to talk about that really, really frankly, and to really have that coming across on the page, but to try and blend that too with the attack on philosophy and with also some philosophical engagement and contemplation. So really I'm trying to confront law, philosophy, ethical regimes with sexuality. I think one of my reviewers says it's a full frontal attack on philosophy, and that's kind of what it's designed to be.
Okay. What is it about philosophy that made you decide that it was an enemy of women's sexuality? Was it your relationship with different philosophers or academics?
Yeah.
Or was it something in the works themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. So I think it's both. It's a personal thing, but it's also an academic and an institutional thing too. And I think that's quite an important thing that I hope comes through in the book. So what did philosophy do so wrong that I decided it needed attacking? I think that the problem with philosophy is that it tends to be endowed with this authority, and it tends to typically be a very Western, very male, very, very white kind of authority, what I guess Deleuze would describe as the difficult kind of authority, the one that's very very kind of entrenched, and this kind of doesn't have a lot to do with women's sexuality, and this kind of philosophical, this problematic authority becomes embodied by philosophers, by academics. And I think this is something that's actually being played out in quite a dramatic fashion since the Me Too kind of movement. There are a lot more stories that are cropping up in academia to do with philosophers, to do with academics generally, that there's this kind of intellectual authority that is quite problematic and can be quite abusive. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that there could be a connection between that abusive authoritarian power, and the words that, that become philosophy, that become that particular intellectual regime, and from which we draw this kind of authority over women's sexuality.
Now, when you are going after philosophy, you're going after the entire history of what we call philosophy. So starting with the Greeks, say.
Okay.
Is that right or no?
I mean, yeah, okay. I mean, we can say that, yeah.
It seemed to me that that's such a large body of work that to characterize all of it as white, for instance, seems to be maybe historically inaccurate.
I mean, there are a lot of white men who wrote philosophy. I mean, that's for sure. And it tends to be this philosophy that forms the architecture. A lot of the intellectual regimes in the West that are given a lot of authority, right?
I worry that you're giving too much away to the whites when you give them the Greeks. Because I don't think they conceived of themselves as white.
Yeah, okay, fine, okay.
So, but what is it about, like, who would you say is the quintessential white male philosopher that might create a model for the rest? Or is this the wrong, am I already off on the wrong foot here trying to create models and...
I guess that is a big problem, isn't it? Is that this whole philosophical movement idea of goals, of definitions, of regimes, of codes, of defining rules by which we should live based on a particular model of what is human? I guess this is the problem. And if I had my way, I guess I'd ask for a much more chaotic model, a kind of an anti-model in some ways, because that's what sexuality is. But yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying. It's like, okay, what do you want then? What kind of philosopher do you want?
Well, I'm just actually not even asking that. I'm asking who what, don't you want? Is it the move to understand and have wisdom itself that is the problem? Something as broad as that? Or is it the idea that the subject-object relationship that is built into some philosophy that is the problem? Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm doing, though, is when I make that move, I mean, I have like an inner Foucault who's saying, yeah, you're already doing philosophy.
Yeah, And I do it too. I do it too. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't want philosophy. And then I find myself, it's irresistible. And there's something quite interesting about that as well, that so long as there's kind of life and a drive to know stuff and to make better ways of living, like we start doing philosophy.
Or we do some sort of critical evaluation, sort of categorical evaluation, or we go through a process of creating categories. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, if you're not going to embrace philosophy as it seems to me that philosophy as a discipline has a number of enemies, and like the major one would be the sciences, like the certain kind of physicist, maybe, who would want to say, The ideas that came from the history of philosophy should be put behind us. We've reached a point now where we have an approach to knowledge which is much more rigorous and satisfactory than whatever would ever come out of the realm of philosophy.
Yeah.
It's called science, and we no longer need this other tradition of, you know, armchair speculation and, you know, wild ideas. We need... the scientific method, testing, experiments, and so forth.
I mean, to be honest, I'm not in favor of the sciences particularly either. I'm certainly not. I mean, okay, science is, I'm sure, great, but I mean, armchair philosophy is kind of not what I'm going for. Certainly, as it relates to female sexuality or women's sexuality. because I think armchair philosophy, but also science, have, both of those two things have been the enemy of women's sexuality. I think it's only now that we've started to develop, with some of the work of some really pioneering women sexologists, we're starting to develop a philosophy of women's pleasure, for instance. And this is an extremely recent thing. But also, there's no philosophical regime necessarily that matches that. Of course, we have feminism, but we also have some problems with that too, because it is a very white feminism. So I think what I'm trying to argue for in the book is a kind of a sexy philosophy, so a philosophy that is connected to the movement of women's sexuality, that we're not kind of distanced in that traditionally very male fashion from the act of sex, because I guess for philosophy and sexuality, there isn't, for philosophy and science, there isn't a problem, I guess, with women's sexuality. That's, it just doesn't really register. And I guess I want to be part of that movement that says, well, actually, yeah, this matters.
What is it about sexuality that is in opposition to the conceptualization that you might find in a philosophical domain? And I guess specifically women's sexuality. Do you think it feel as though women's sexuality is precognitive, like it's unmediated and direct?
That's a very philosophical question.
See, but look, yeah, I feel as though you've tied my hands behind my back. I can't exactly. And see, now already I feel also as though that was an unintentionally sexualized metaphor. But the point here is that
I was going to say that's so bad. Yeah.
But my point here is just that I feel as though I'm hamstrung. I can't. I don't know how to proceed without the tools of I guess philosophy, which is the thing. It's my thing. But I'm going to let you talk. I'm just going to shut up for a minute and let you tell me where things are at.
Where things are at?
Like, yeah. What? I mean, I'm going to let you respond to my dilemma. How about that?
Okay. I mean, you're a bit stuck, to be honest. And I feel bad for you because it's difficult. Like if you're a philosopher, that's what you are, and it's quite difficult, I think, to think in terms of women's sexuality, and I guess like that's fine, but I guess it becomes a problem when you start to try and make judgments about women's sexuality, which you're not doing, but there are philosophers, there are intellectual regimes, there's the legal regime in particular, which is very good at making judgments, which likes to say things about women's sexuality, which aren't necessarily true, which are a lot of the time untrue, and are also at times can be actively harmful.
Well, for instance, give me an example of some of the things, the judgments about women's sexuality that are produced By philosophers.
I suppose.
Or scientists, or by the law.
I mean, the law is an easy one to kind of get to grips with. So if you talk about consent, for instance, and this is obviously a big deal at the moment, post Me Too, it's a big deal because there are problems too with the way that the consent legal framework works in practice, because there's still the issue that women are deemed to be consenting in particular circumstances or not to be consenting in particular circumstances. I'm sure we're all familiar with the idea that if a woman has been drinking to a certain extent, there's a lot of controversy about at what point she's able to consent to, or the kind of things that women actually desire in sex and don't desire in sex. So these kind of things are just not talked about in court or in the law. But instead the law tends to just make a judgment. It's like, well, it will facilitate a judgment in terms of, okay, she was drunk, she was flirting with him, she was kissing him, that's therefore consent, she wanted it. Do you see what I mean? It's that kind of thing that comes through in law. But actually, we haven't got the body of empirical knowledge to say, well, actually, no, that this is just not true. This is just not how women are sexually.
How would you approach consent when it comes to alcohol?
How would I approach it?
Yeah, or someone, what would be a more liberating approach to the question of consent and alcohol consumption?
Do you mean
for women?
Do you mean consumption by an, a victim of hate?
You could start by saying by a victim, sure. I mean, but we're trying to establish whether or not someone's been victimized. Mm. So you would say, I mean, in court, I'm imagining that the idea here is to discover the guilt or innocence of a perpetrator.
Yeah.
And so you want to set up, I guess, a way to approach, maybe a method of approaching the question of consent when alcohol is involved.
But
maybe you don't. So how would you approach it? Maybe you don't want to set up a rule. Maybe you want to do something else. So I just, like, maybe you don't want to say, okay, blood alcohol level this amount, it means no consent is possible, or you don't want to do anything like that. So how would you approach the question of consent?
I think altogether that our approach to women in sexual offences is wrong. I mean, there's a lot of focus on what she's drunk, on her behaviour, on what she's wearing, on what she's doing in terms of causing somebody to commit an offence against her, which is just simply wrong. That's not the way that we ought to be judging a sexual encounter here. What we need to be looking at is instead focusing on understanding women's sexuality for a start, what women desire, what women's pleasures are, what their pleasures aren't, and focusing on the offender's behaviour. Because I think the way that we currently do it is, of course, we have a rule by which these cases are judged, but I'm suggesting that perhaps these rules, in light of the reality of sexual encounters, are wrong.
So how would you define or understand a woman's sexuality? Is there such a thing as consent? How about that? I'll start there. Would that be even a useful category?
That is a big question. That's a big question. I mean, consent at the moment is an extremely useful framework because, it's all we've got, isn't it? So, I mean, what are we going to do? We need something by which we can understand a standard.
Cutting out a little bit.
This woman was not. Oh, sorry. It might be my internet connection.
It sounds better now. Say that again, maybe.
Okay. So I think consent is important that we have it because it's a line, it's a standard that's set for society. What I'm saying is that we perhaps need to rethink the way that we use this line. Perhaps consent isn't fit for purpose in the end. Perhaps in the end we will discover that actually we need an entirely new framework because the way that the consent is currently formulated I don't think is necessarily helpful. It's defined as a free choice, and how we define freedom and how we define choice in the context of sexuality is really contested. So perhaps we do need to radically rethink consent as a useful instrument at all.
I had a conversation with Heidi Matthews a few months back, and in that conversation she was talking about the ways in which the framing around sexuality in the law and specifically the question of consent was being challenged by radical feminists who felt that another standard should be used, perhaps something like enthusiasm or pleasure even, that for instance, if there was a sexual encounter and the woman felt as though she had been, I mean, maybe she said yes, but she felt violated or felt abused or neglected,
that that would be grounds for a criminal investigation, rather than trying to establish if she had technically given consent.
I think that's an interesting approach, and I think it certainly starts to address the gap between the technicality and between the reality, I guess, of women's sexuality. And I think enthusiasm, pleasure could be quite interesting standards to use. I guess then we have the issue of defining what that looks like, or establishing what that looks like.
I guess, right, because it wouldn't simply be a matter of a woman like having an orgasm or something like that, right? Because, you know, a non-consensual encounter might produce such a thing. You know, it that wouldn't be any kind of grounds for, like, if you were in court and the rapist said, "Well, she came," that's hardly any defense, right?
No,
so it's right. So that it wouldn't be a standard in that kind of standard that we're talking about. It would be something else. It would be, I guess, maybe the woman would decide whether or not the encounter was some sort of violation, perhaps after the fact.
Yeah, it's really tough because, I mean, in one sense, consent, I think, is very clear. When you have consent and when you don't, I think it's pretty damn obvious. At the same time, we can see through this kind of discussion and the discussions that a lot of thinkers and feminists and legal scholars are having shows that the woman, the female body, or the body of a person with a vulva has this power to completely throw everything into confusion, particularly the law, because the standards are just so radically different for every person. And that's kind of what I try and show in the book through kind of tracing my kind of responses to different encounters and my own arousal and showing that actually these kind of lines are really complex.
So what is it about the woman's body per se that presents such a challenge, rather than maybe the relationship between people that presents a challenge?
I guess it's because the collective we, as in the kind of the intellectual we, the philosophical, the scientific we, kind of hasn't taken the trouble necessarily or had the time or deemed it important enough to perhaps understand enough about the bodies of women, particularly the sexuality of women. I mean, as I say, these kind of scientific developments and an understanding of women's pleasure have been quite recent. So I think that for that reason, the woman's body is kind of that force of incoherence against the law, against philosophy. And I think for that reason, it's really important to talk about women rather than just relationships between people.
Do you feel but the woman's body specifically? So yeah. Do you think that a more thoroughgoing scientific understanding of the anatomy of women would help us get closer to solving questions around consent?
I guess it would help. It would definitely help, but it's not everything.
Most men now at least know where the clitoris is. I mean, you have to give us that. It's
a
joke. That was a joke.
Did you have a nice time, dear?
Very nice, thanks.
Well, you don't look much like a girl who's been out having a wonderful evening.
Mom. No, here.
Well, what's the matter, dear?
Do you remember when you told me that I might have such strong feelings about a boy that it might be hard for me to decide what's right to do?
Yes, I remember, but why?
Well, it was something like that tonight with Jeff. You know, I like him an awful lot, and we have such fun at dances. Tonight, feeling between us kept getting stronger and stronger. On our way home, we stopped and parked. And then things seemed to happen. Too we nearly. Well, it was so close. Suddenly, I realized what we were about to do. I asked Jeff to take me home. I guess he felt ashamed, too. He said he was sorry that it was his fault.
Do you think it was his fault?
Oh, Mother, I don't know what to think. I'm so mixed up. I don't know whether I even want to go out with Jeff again.
You know, dear, I was young once, too. Perhaps I can understand something of what you feel. First, well, it all seems quite a lark. You like someone, he likes you. Everything is fun and affection. Then, all at once, you can find yourself in a situation where your physical urges fight against your reason. Then those fine thoughts of love and affection can suddenly get twisted.
Mother, is it wrong to feel warm and affectionate when you're with a boy you really like?
No, dear, it is not wrong. Because this feeling can grow into a love that will last. It's the way happy marriages are built. But Mary, if these strong feelings lead you into behaving unwisely, well, the outcome can be guilt and frustration. And these are the things that can spoil the chance of your finding the very love that you're looking for.
Then, Mother, how do you...
Come here, dear. In the height of emotion, it's not always easy to stop and think things through. But if you'll just slow down the rush and pressure of your feelings a little, then judgment has a better chance to take hold and guide you away from wrong behavior. When you can rely on judgment rather than emotion to rule your behavior, as you did tonight, then you'll really be grown up. I can help by talking things over with you and giving suggestions, but you'll have to work out your own best way to make emotions work for you and not against you.
In the realm of law, the trouble is that there's this woman's body that doesn't really fit within the realm of legal cognition, say, that presents something insurmountable that can't be taken up by Western models of justice and law. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
And what would the political consequence of understanding that be?
Ugh, big question.
Yeah, big philosophical question. But not really, because I think it's a political question. I don't think it's a philosophical one. I think it's like a question about how we should live rather than what is or how we understand the world or what it is to be.
Well, what are the practical consequences? I'd like to think that some of the kind of practical implications would be that women would not have to kind of suffer quite so much and so often as I think they do as part of abusive relationships, some of which I talk about in my book that I've been part of.
Do you want to move away from this kind of philosophical or pseudo-philosophical and maybe tell the story of how you came to write this book, the personal aspect of the book?
Yeah, we can do that, definitely. Because, I mean, I guess it's probably the most important motivation for not only writing the book, but for this project entirely, and my career, I guess, in a way, is that that I suppose I've always had quite difficult relationships. When I've had relationships with men, they've been quite difficult until recently. And the relationship that I talk about specifically in the book was, I think, particularly interesting because it was the combination of both a very personalized form of kind of abuse of my sexuality, but also it was kind of a sort of an intellectual power game, if you want to call it that, at the same time. So it was a very sort of toxic form of abuse. But it also, it was interesting in that it coincided with my PhD project at the time, which was also problematic in terms of my institution because it was going through what's called an ethical approval regime. So it needs to be kind of approved that I go to this public sex speech and do my project. So it was quite interesting that I had the coincidence of both a very difficult personal situation and a difficult institutional situation.
The man you were with was your professor? Is that right?
He wasn't my professor, so he wasn't anything to do with my work at my institution. But he was somebody who I was in a relationship with at the time, who was a professor of philosophy at the time.
Okay, but you never received any grades from him or anything like that. You were never.
Oh no, no, that would be okay. Weird.
Yeah, so. So how did these things, your academic work and your fraught relationship with this philosopher, intersect?
In quite kind of interesting ways. So whilst I was at the public sex speech doing my project, which was in the south of France, I was receiving this professor was married as well, just to add that in, which I think is an important detail.
Did you know that when you started up with him, or was he okay? So he didn't deceive you on that front. Okay, go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine, and he obviously knew that as well. So everybody knows.
Everybody knew that, except for probably the wife didn't know what was going on.
Well, yes. Exactly. I'm at the beach doing my project, and I'm getting these really intense, kind of very very jealous emails, so very possessive emails, but also ones that kind of speculated in this very sort of strange way about my desires in being in that space. So he was kind of saying, well, obviously you want to have sex with lots of people because otherwise why would you be at this beach, when actually I kind of didn't. I was like actually thinking, oh, I kind of want to go home. This is actually quite a difficult space to be in. There's a lot of pressure associated with it because those kind of environments just are. But it was quite odd how he was really kind of thrown into a very sort of weird jealous spiral where he was like, oh no, I don't want you to do it, but actually I want you to do it because obviously you want to. And I'm all the time saying, well, actually no, I don't. So it was quite an interesting kind of cycle. But at the same time, my institution had said to me, well, you know, you need to be really careful because lots of people are going to be seeking a sexual encounter and you need to be careful about privacy concerns and all of this kind of stuff. And I was like, well, that's not simple either, because that's kind of saying, well, obviously you're going to be putting yourself in danger and you're a woman, so we need to be extra worried about you.
Can we talk briefly about this space that you were going into just sort of on its own for a moment?
Yeah.
So were there rules in this beach? Was it in any way institutionalized, or was it simply like a liminal space where people would go to and have an expectation of something like a public orgy? What was happening on this beach?
So it was part of a resort. It's a naked village basically. So people go there as naturists or nudists or whatever and they live a particular lifestyle. But there's a particular section of the beach, sort of a kilometer square, that is really for public sex. So people go there. It's a swinging space, basically, where people, all kinds of different sexualities will go there in the expectation of some point of having a sexual encounter on the beach or in the dunes or in the sea or, you know, whatever takes their fancy at a certain point. And it's not too hot and it's not too sandy. You know, it's, yeah.
And were there more men than women congregating in that space?
There was more single men than there were single women, for sure. I was on my own there, and I was in a minority as a woman on my own. A lot of couples, so male female couples, also gay couples too. But I mean, there were, I would say there were more men than women. Yes, definitely.
The gay couples that were they mostly men, or were there lesbian couples there?
I didn't find any lesbian couples. They were mostly men, yeah.
So it sounds like it was a male-oriented space, like it was a sort of, like I kind of imagine women who would be part of these couples sort of being dragged along to this part of the beach, not entirely involuntarily, but sort of cajoled into, hey, it will be fun, honey, let's...
And you're actually on the money there, really, because this was my feeling, because I'd been there actually before, a year before, with a boyfriend at the time, and I didn't really want to go, and I've never really wanted to go. There's something about it that fascinates me. I don't know quite what it is yet, and I guess once I realise that, then I'll have the answer to a lot of things. But I guess it's like, well, why? What is it that draws people here? And what is this kind of weird, sinister thing of women going but not really wanting to, and men kind of... I mean, I'm not saying that every woman is there against their will. I'm really not, because I'm sure there are a lot of women who had an amazing time there. And, you know, from my observations, like, a lot of women seem to be having a good time, but then what does that look like? Who am I to say that that's what's happening? And I guess it's always that human emphasis on appearance, and everyone looks like they're having a good time, therefore they are having a good time, therefore everyone's consenting and everyone's happy. But I'm sure there are some very complex relationship dynamics that are going on underneath all that.
So did you go and make it clear that you were there as an academic to observe and that you weren't interested in a sexual encounter, or did you keep that to yourself? Were you open to the, even though you didn't want to, were you open to the idea of getting involved in a tryst?
Yeah, I was always open to the idea, because I thought there's something very false about saying you're an academic and you're not interested. I'm just here watching and taking notes. And it's also a bit creepy, I think, to do that.
People might think you're a cop.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah, that as well. But also just maybe a bit weird, even in that quite unusual context. So I was there, and I just treated each day as a day at the beach. I would have my notebook with me, and I'd be writing a lot of the time. But I would also be open to things going on around me, and sometimes I would find myself participating either just by, you know, by looking at somebody, or there's kind of these little things happen between people, aren't there, that aren't necessarily physical, or they are physical but you're not touching necessarily, and sometimes it would become something more physical, but it would just depend on what was happening. I never had what you would call full sex at the beach, because I didn't want to. But I mean, I must say that it's not a sexy space. And it's like what you were saying before, it's a very male space. It is built around what I would suggest is male sexuality. But there are kind of these pockets and occasions where you can kind of, there is a sort of femininity that kind of just crops up sometimes.
I recall a stand-up comic once asking the question rhetorically in an act, why is it that all the people who are polyamorous are the last people on earth you'd want to have sex with? And why are swingers so unattractive?
That is everything. And I don't think it's just about swinging. It's not about the people necessarily that are unattractive. It's about, there's something about this absolute honesty. I was talking about this with a lover of mine, actually, and there's something about it that's just unsexy. As soon as you're saying, there's this code that we live by, and it's this kind of very open, very honest thing, there's something that's a big turnoff, and I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, I understand what you're talking about. I don't know if I can put my finger on it, but I think what it is just right there. It's this idea that you can be direct and honest without slipping up. That, you know, like I say, I can't put my finger on it, and that's a double entendre, and I didn't intend to say it, but that's how that always works. Do you see what, you know, see what I'm saying? So it's like, if you try to go into a space and say, no, we're not gonna play any games like that, we're just gonna be very direct, then, you know, everything gets reduced down to this sort of mechanical level, perhaps. You know, you might as well go in with an anatomy textbook and just, you know, describe what you want in terms of, you know, in Latin or something like that.
Yeah.
So maybe there's almost a medicalization of the process when you try to be so direct.
And I think that's when the romance just goes, or whatever it is, the spark or what it is about sexuality and drawing people together, it just gets completely eradicated because it just becomes just a set of rules. Which,
did you tell your philosophy lover this sort of thing at the time when it was going on? Do you think that, or if you had, would it have made any difference?
I did, yes, I did. At great length. I think I say in the book at some point, there's like 10,000 emails between us over a period of a year and a half, and some of them are very long. Some of them are like 20,000 words of kind of meditations on my sexuality, and all the time I'm just like, well, to be honest, I just didn't really want to be there. And it's a funny thing that can be difficult, which is also interesting. It's difficult sometimes to be told something about women's sexuality, I think, as a man sometimes, because it's something that you can't necessarily have control over, but a certain type of person might want to have control over something, and I guess this is what this man was trying to do. So it's quite difficult to hear that, oh, actually, that there's nothing there. There is no kind of, somebody who's very intellectual, but at the same time very motherly, at the same time a little bit slutty, like that kind of unicorn doesn't really exist. And I guess it can be sometimes quite difficult to hear that.
He didn't want to hear you describe your actual feelings and subjectivity because he had a fantasy version of you that he was holding on to that was sort of standing in the way of his understanding of who you actually were?
Yeah, I think so. And I think once that happens, that's it, really. There's nothing you can do. There was nothing I could do to undo it, but I still wanted to try. I guess I had a stake in it too, but, you know, I guess when you're in love with somebody, you kind of want them to understand
and,
you.
And instead, what happened was you said, no, let me tear this veil aside, and you should look at me as I actually am rather than as you want me to be. And his response was, well, no, I much prefer my fantasy to you. Is that basically how that what came down?
Exactly. It's like, I want to know how bad you are, and how bad you are is this, which means that therefore you're bad. That's it. And that's something that kind of he wanted
to be out there enjoying it all and being and wrapped up in some sort of sex adventure. And he also wanted to be terribly jealous and unhappy about it.
Yeah, it's a very way to want to be. But, you know, I guess some people.
And I can't imagine, I can't imagine a woman saying the same thing to a man. I want you to go out there and be slutty and sleep around with all these women or men or whatever. Maybe with men, but I don't know. Can't imagine the roles being reversed for some reason.
No, I can't imagine it either. I mean, I guess it might be possible, but I can't imagine it. And that's quite interesting too.
So what kinds of things in general do you think that men have trouble hearing from women when it comes to their sexuality or their identity?
The idea that women can be more than one thing. So that the possibility that women might desire casual sex, I mean, genuinely desire casual sex without fitting a stereotype of a very promiscuous woman, I think is a difficult thing for women, for men to understand. And actually, when I say men, I probably mean society, actually, generally, as a kind of assumption. I think the idea that women could both be sort of desiring of intimacy, of a very sort of family-based relationship with a man, as well as being a bit slutty, I think is also something that's very difficult to hear. That people can be a lot of things sexually, women can be a lot of things sexually, I think is difficult to hear. The fact that they can be one way with a particular man, or have a, I mean, for instance, my philosopher lover at the time knew that I'd had a past where I'd had quite a lot of sex with a lot of different people. And this meant that he found it impossible to believe that I might want a monogamous relationship of any kind. So I think it's just difficult for men to accept that the kind of changes in sexual states and desire, the possibility that...
Do you think he would have had less trouble understanding that or believing you if he hadn't been married?
Possibly. I mean, that's a whole other can of worms, isn't it, really, when you start thinking about why people are married and have relationships that aren't within that marriage. And I guess sometimes, not always, definitely not always, but sometimes I think there can be a sort of power thing going on there too.
I would imagine so. I just remember something that a philosopher, Slavoj Žižek, once said about mistresses and men who have mistresses, which is that they think that what they want is to be with their mistress, to have this perfect relationship, that, you know, you're with your wife and your wife has probably become more like an ordinary person to you over years, but the mistress is still a fantasy, and you feel like, oh, if I can only have this fantasy, then my life would be fulfilled and I'd be fulfilled. But the truth is that it's only because of the triangle, the only because of the mistress can't be the wife, that the mistress is in that position outside of the marriage. It's only with the marriage that the mistress actually has that power. Otherwise, it just becomes an ordinary relationship.
Yeah.
And it just gets deflated. Mm. So like, you know... I think that you were in a kind of impossible situation.
Yeah, it's like I had power, but I mean, I obviously didn't have power.
But you only had power as long as nothing changed.
Yeah.
You know, as long as he didn't leave his wife, you had power.
Yeah, and you know what? Thank God he didn't, because, you know, I would have been stuck with something. probably wouldn't have been stuck with it for very long, to be honest. But yeah, it's an interesting idea, actually, that whole power relationship and whether the mistress relationship is possible without the marriage. I'm quite interested in that idea. I might expect something I'll continue thinking about.
Well, maybe we should move back into the realm of philosophy a bit. We've kind of described a bit of the story that's in your book, but I guess I want to ask you why you seem to allow for one or two philosophers to, you know, escape from the guillotine and still take up a section of your book in your own thinking And that, I guess, would be Deleuze and Guattari. I always want to say guitar when I pronounce his name, which is wrong.
I never.
But Guattari, right? Is that how you say it?
But yeah.
But they're figures that somehow manage not to get lumped in with the rest of white male philosophy so much in your book, it seems to me. Is that right?
I mean, it is right, but they're not allowed to pass entirely. I'm not letting them on. I guess I include a lot of Deleuzean thought because he. Along with Guattari, is that their work is the first kind of philosophical work that I encountered. And I fell deeply, deeply in love with it. And I still love Deleuze and Guattari's work. I love the way together, but the way that they write together as well, because I think something really magical happens. And I've got a really deep passion for their work. But I think the reason for that and the reason that they kind of get a quasi pass is because there is something quite sexual about the way that they write or the way that I read their writing. In that they have this, I mean, actually, they talk about the power of text, and a lot of feminist thought has taken the power of text to and their text to be quite erotic, in that it somehow plays with the self at the same time as playing with words and this kind of stuff. So, and it sort of plays with the idea of dissolution into the collective and all this kind of stuff. So I guess that kind of stuff is, it's quite arousing. Both intellectually, and I think also it can be physically too. So they get a bit of a pass. But also another philosopher who gets a pass is Paul Preciado, because his work uses this kind of continental thought, and he kind of plays with it in a way that he tries to take the head from philosophy. And to kind of help us to think with our bodies rather than with our minds. And the way of doing this is through this kind of headless philosophy. So yes, some philosophers kind of do work their way through. And I guess that's because they're part of me as well. Everything that I had read and took with me, as part of my body sitting on that beach, it's kind of all of that philosophy, and I don't think that I can separate it out. I don't think that there is a non-philosophical answer to any of the questions that I ask about women's sexuality and the connection between philosophy and women's sexuality. So it's that question again, isn't it, about whether you can give a non-philosophical answer to anything. There we are again.
Well, yeah, there we are. I feel like it's appropriate to begin and end our conversation back with the same problem of how to escape from philosophy.
Exactly. Yeah.
Something that you want to do more than I do, but I will say this: that I feel as though the idea of a woman thinking with her body is far less threatening than the idea of a man thinking with his body.
Yeah.
When I think of a man thinking with his body rather than with his brain, I think of something rather brutish and dangerous. And somehow, because of the culture I was brought up in, probably, I don't think that way when it comes to women. I don't think that if women thought with their body, we would be at risk in the same way.
Yeah.
Men need to be constrained by their brains. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but I guess that is a bit of a problem, isn't it? That whole idea that men are the ones who are violent, who have the capacity to be very brutal, and that need the mind to kind of mediate that and so on. Whereas women are the soft ones. We're not the ones who are violent and have the capacity to really shake things up, and that our kind of intellectual power is kind of soft. Our physical power is very soft, and I think that's also something that I'm battling there as well.
See, I wouldn't go that far, because I would say that if women were to only think with their brains and not succumb to their bodies, that that men would have a lot of trouble.
Women can
usually outthink men.
Yeah.
Well, we're all in trouble, really.
Yeah, that's true, and that's a really appropriate note to finish on. We're all basically going to end.